It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. President Trump is labeling an elite Iranian military group as a terrorist organization, a move that's getting mixed reviews inside his administration. We'll find out what the announcement means coming up. Now, the 15th annual State of the Tribes address was delivered at the state capitol this afternoon. The address brings together the 11 federally recognized tribes of Wisconsin. It was delivered this year by Oneida Chairman Tahasi Hill. Chairman Hill's address covered a wide range of topics, including education, mining, climate change, the opioid crisis, and how tribal governments can work with the state on those and other issues. Aaron Bird Bear is an assistant dean for student diversity programs for the UW-Madison School of Education. He is Mandan, Hidatsa, and Diné, and a tribally enrolled citizen of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation. He was a principal architect of WisconsinFirstNations.org, a partnership between the School of Education and Wisconsin Public Television. Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, honey, chata hi, P. I'm happy to be here. Said hello in the Ho-Chunk language.
And you were at the Capitol today to attend the address. Can you set the scene for us, Aaron?
Yeah, it's an incredibly special event where we have, walking into the beginning of the event, we have drums singing some honor songs. So having this incredible cultural expression within the Capitol Dome is a meaningful moment, at least for me. And then we have the Eagle Staffs, which represent the different First Nations of Wisconsin. They're kind of the equivalent of the American flag that we have that represents our nation. And so having the Eagle Staff enter the combined Senate and Assembly floor, along with the United States colors, is an extraordinarily powerful moment to see this nation-to-nation relationship between the First Nations of Wisconsin, the United States, and the Wisconsin state government.
We'll get into some of the details of Chairman Hill's address, but overall, what struck you about what he had to say to state lawmakers and the governor?
It's just a really positive moment to think about the ways that we can collaborate and support one another. First Nations of Wisconsin offer all sorts of services that serve Native Americans and non-Native Americans alike. And similarly, the various services of the state government in Wisconsin serves Native Americans and non-Native Americans alike. So it's just a wonderful, positive moment to think about the ways that both governments of the First Nations of Wisconsin and the state government can hopefully provide the best services to the citizens of the state.
Can you talk a little bit about the interaction between those governments? Here in Wisconsin and in other states, you have the state government, the tribal governments, federal government laws affect both of those differently. It can get kind of complicated, right?
It is. In 2004, then-Governor Jim Doyle issued Executive Order 39. Executive orders come and go. But at the time, it really provided a basic guidance for how cabinet agencies will recognize the unique legal relationship between the state of Wisconsin and the Indian nations and respect fundamental principles that establish and maintain these relationships. And so it's just a wonderful system of liaising where all these tribal liaisons within state government, say Department of Transportation, Health and Human Services, and how they can coordinate their service efforts together. And so I think it's just a really amazing kind of moment in the 21st century where the Wisconsin government is proactively seeking to establish better services for citizenry through collaboration with the governments of the First Nations.
I think you said the executive order was 2004, and this is the 15th State of the Tribe address. Were the two related? Am I doing the math right there?
They are. Executive Order 39 kind of launched the State of the Tribes initiative in the sense that this address kind of talks about what are the priorities of First Nations in the state and how what areas are we doing well and what areas do we have areas for growth within. So I think it's really amazing that this executive order established in the 21st century this unprecedented era of cooperation between Native Americans and non-Native Americans that we've never seen in the history of our country. And it's just a very visible reminder of this new era of collaboration and cooperation.
And a little more about the history of the address itself. It's delivered by a rotating group, right, of the leaders of the various tribal nations around the state?
That's correct. Every year, a different leader, one of the civic leaders of the First Nations of Wisconsin, is selected to deliver the address. A couple years ago, Gary Bisaw, the president of the Nominee Nation. Previous year's Chris McGeesick from St. Croix. So it's been wonderful to see the different perspectives and ways of communicating that these First Nation leaders share with us, the public, and the elected representatives of the state of Wisconsin's government.
Talking to Aaron Bird-Bear from the UW-Madison, looking at today's State of the Tribes address delivered before the state legislature and the governor today. Want to get into some of the particulars. A big part of the address focused on issues related to the environment, climate change, and mining and water health. Here is the chairman talking about that.
Protecting high-quality environmental resources and repairing damage is not a political policy. It is a responsibility.
A big part of the address, as I mentioned, related to the environment. Can you talk about some of what Chairman Hill had to say?
Yeah, the really important component for First Nations is, since we've been here for 12,000-plus years in this particular part of Turtle Island, or what people call North America or the United States, that protecting that environment is something that's really important to us, because we value not only ourselves as human beings on planet Earth, but we also value all the living beings, plants and animals. We want to ensure that we adhere to this compact we made with nature to sustain it in a vibrant and healthy way, so that not only do we have a high quality of life as human beings, but the plants have a high quality of life, the animals have a high quality of life. So in this compact with nature, protecting the environment is just a really important component of sustaining that compact. So, say, all this mining that has been attempted in the state of Wisconsin over the last 20 years in particular, these multinational conglomerates come in and there are resources to extract, but they come with incredible harm to the environment. And so the type of leach mining with different chemicals is going to contaminate watersheds and water basins. And so that compact of nature would be definitely violated in some sense to the incredible harm that comes with this mining and all the chemicals that are placed in the land. So it's been really impressive to see the First Nations of Wisconsin, particularly those of the North, who've been successful in pushing back mining effort after mining effort. And in particular, the most recent ones, the Menominee Nation and the Back 40 mine, which would actually occur right where the Menominee's creation story says they come to be as a people. And so here is a Menominee Nation fighting for the protection of the environment where their origin story says they came to be. And so I think it's very important to sustain the health of this environment in places that are so important to the First Nations of Wisconsin.
And in additionally, go ahead.
No, that's fine.
Chairman Hill, in his address, talked about some of the particular mining projects you just mentioned. He also focused on bigger picture environmental issues like climate change. And he was encouraging the state of Wisconsin and tribal groups to work together on climate change issues. Can you talk about that focus?
Yeah, I think First Nations are an incredible kind of litmus. I mean, we're some ways canary in the coal mine about climate change. You know, our ways of being, our cultures, our languages are all shaped from interacting so intimately with the environment over thousands of years. So our knowledge bases and our understanding of this environment are just go back generation after generation after generation. And with climate change, changing the behavior of plants, changing the behavior of the environment in relation to water, suddenly harvesting wild rice was an issue in the last few years. Wild rice requires extraordinarily clean water and extraordinarily stable water levels. And so wild rice harvests in northern Wisconsin have been interrupted by climate change. The Alaska Native Nations, they have been experiencing this for 20-plus years already. Climate change has impacted them so quickly. And so I think First Nations have just an amazing window into how quickly climate change is impacting our ways of being. And it's an interest of First Nations to collaborate with science and with government to find ways to mitigate these changes for the well-being of all plants and animals.
Now, there's, of course, a lot of diversity among Wisconsin's tribal nations and First Nations around the continent, but I've seen people talking about a growing common interest, growing cooperation between various nations on environmental issues. Do you see this as a rising movement, a trend we should be watching?
Yeah, I see this incredible, you know, social movement coming our way, because as water becomes a more and more precious resource, and as disruption to agricultural crops and different things are going to force us to reconcile our behaviors as human beings on planet Earth, I think the Native American nations are dedicated to thinking about how we can contribute to adaptation. The National Adaptation Forum will be here in Madison in later this April. And the First Nations presentations within the National Adaptation Forum are incredibly deep. So we have these First Nations from around the United States and from the First Nations of Wisconsin all coming together to think about what are the behavior changes we can think about to help mitigate climate change impacts that are caused by our behaviors as human beings. So I think it's an exciting time for innovation, for science and First Nations to all collaborate together to think about how we can continue to have healthy lives for our children, our children's children, and seven generations down the road.
We're talking to Aaron Bird Bear right now, Assistant Dean for Student Diversity Programs at UW-Madison School of Education, with us today to talk about the annual State of the Tribes Address delivered today by Oneida Chairman Tahasi Hill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What were some of your takeaways from today's speech? We'll cover a lot of the issues apart from the environment coming up. What would you like to hear more about? If you're a member of a Wisconsin tribe, what issues are you focusing on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about today's State of the Tribes Address. Aaron Bird Bear is with us from the UW-Madison, Principal Architect of WisconsinFirstNations.org. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you listen or watch today's address? What did you think of what you heard? If you're a member of one of Wisconsin's tribes, what would you like to see addressed in the state moving forward? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chairman Hill used some of his address to look at education. I want to look at Act 31 that requires public school districts to provide instruction on tribal history and sovereignty. And Chairman Hill talking about a proposed change in that that I think he liked. Here's a listen.
Our amendments to Act 31 must teach that we, as Native people, are alive, vibrant, and thriving. Our cultures are alive, vibrant, and thriving.
Aaron, can you talk about that act, what it did, and what could change?
Yeah, the Act 31 was born in the 1989-1991 biennium budget. And we always say that, you know, new educational policies just don't drop out of the sky. There was a really unfortunate conflict and a misunderstanding of treaty rights in the state of Wisconsin. Treaties are made nation to nation. Native Americans are in constitutional law, Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution. And so, unfortunately, there's a misunderstanding of treaty rights, and there was a conflict over resources in northern Wisconsin, particularly walleye fish. And it led to a four-year prolonged violent confrontation in northern Wisconsin where the National Guard eventually had to be enacted to quell the civil unrest. And because of that, we realized we needed to have an expectation to understand the ways of being of First Nations, the treaty rights within ceded lands. And so this educational expectation emerged to educate about Native Americans at least twice in elementary, at least once in high school, to teach treaty rights, to teach the history, culture, and tribal sovereignty of the First Nations of Wisconsin and all public schools. It is an unfunded and unenforced mandate. And unfortunately, with the testing pressures that all public school teachers and administrators face today, social studies, for the most part, has been pushed to the margins of instruction, with quantitative and English and writing being more prominently tested. And within that, teaching about Native Americans has also been kind of pushed to the side, like parsley on the plate. And so I think there's a sincere interest for thinking how we can embed the instruction of the First Nations throughout every year in high school. So five of the six bills presented to expand Act 31, instead of just being taught at least twice in elementary and at least once in high school, to have a more unified curriculum for teaching this particular expectation and helping teachers understand, you know, what resources are available to them to accomplish this instruction, and well as have a little more instruction instead of just twice and having it more frequently for students to engage this type of learning.
And Chairman Hill also focused on health care and health disparities that face many Native Americans here in Wisconsin. What kind of things was he pointing toward?
We're hoping for thinking about the health care system, which I mentioned treaty-based relationships, you know, in ceding our lands to the United States and its expansion into Turtle Island, or what is called North America. In ceding our lands, the United States, through treaty, is obligated to provide a health care system for us. And he described the chronic underfunding of that healthcare system to a point where Native American healthcare is funded at a third of that of the rest of U.S. citizens. It's even funded at about half of that of what prison inmates receive in terms of healthcare today. And so the disparities we have are historic in the sense that Indian wars, reservation, coercive assimilation of removing children from their families for generations, almost 100 years, has left us with a tremendous amount of chronic issues in health. And so since it's underfunded, we're trying to think of ways that how can the state do actions like the expansion of Medicaid that would really aid tribal citizens to have a better healthcare system to meet their needs in mental health needs, chronic diabetes needs, substance abuse needs. And so it's just really a discussion about, although most of these are federal obligations between the federal government and each Native Nation to provide a healthcare system for each citizen of the First Nation, there are ways that the state can partner with First Nations to help enhance and address the tribal disparities that Native Americans face today.
We're talking about today's State of the Tribes address delivered by UNITA Chairman Ta-Hasi Hill. Aaron Bird Bear is with us. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Patrick is with us in Richland Center. Patrick, hi.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for your guest. Do you think it's fair to say that since the Republicans have been in charge in Madison, you know, open for business, I'm sure you remember that, the reason that they have taken away just about all the local control over water rights, meaning, you know, high-capacity wells, how many of them can be drilled in your neighborhood, and also on the pollution part where, as locals, you can't say anything, have no control over a big business doing a bunch of nasty pollution. Would it be fair to say that the reason that the Republicans enacted that legislation was so that when an multinational, maybe like Foxconn, comes along, they can reassure them, saying, hey, don't worry about the water and the pollution, because the locals, we've taken that right away from a long time ago. And so it makes them easier for them to sell us out.
Patrick, thanks for the call. Aaron, is that a concern people saw, for example, with the mining questions that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, I think we as First Nations have watched the United States kind of ebb and flow in its commitments to the environment, commitments to managing natural resources. I think the U.S. government, the U.S. society kind of, you know, oscillates between deregulation and increased regulation for safety and well-being. I think we've just seen a period of deregulation that, you know, obviously enhances business, but often at the cost for all the public in terms of the environment around us and how it's managed. And is it sustainably managed, or is it being managed in a way that the resources are depleting? So we First Nations are in here for the long haul. We've been here for thousands of years. We'll be here for thousands of more. And I think we're just trying to provide our guidance on how we understand these systems and the balance within the ecological systems around us, and what are the best ways we can manage these resources for, you know, the next 12,000 years. My favorite statement, the president of the Menominee Nation said when he visited the UW-Madison campus, and he spoke to our leadership of our campus, he said, the Menominee have been here for 12,000 years. We plan to be here 12,000 more. And I think to be here for 12,000 more, we have to think about balanced ways for managing the environment. And part of that is voting. And we, the public, have to think about what ways that we can elect different leaders who are concerned about the management of the environment. And this, it kind of oscillates back and forth as U.S. society kind of still is a pretty young society, trying to figure out what values are at the center of our society. And yes, we need growth. We need economic sustainability for everyone. At the same time, you know, we can't entirely trash this place because we still have to live here as well.
Patrick, thanks for that call. I want to give another listen to Chairman Hill and his State of the Tribes address here, talking about a legislative focus of the tribes, eliminating the use of Native American logos, mascots, and nicknames in school facilities. Here's a listen.
The use of Indian imagery stereotypes and dehumanizes our cultures and Native American people for the sake of entertainment. Furthermore, it encourages racist and vulgar behavior in the name of school spirit, which is both socially and academically detrimental to all children.
It got some applause from the chamber, but this has been a long running back and forth over the mascot issue. Aaron, what are you watching for as this goes on to yet another year of debate over this?
Well, you know, I'm really hopeful that we listen to the mental health research bodies of the United States. Native American mascots, and particularly in K-12 public education environments, are proven through psychological research to be harmful. They are agents of harm. And as we always describe, if we know that there's an agent of harm impacting youth in educational environments that we control, and we don't care about that, or we choose not to acknowledge the harm that's happening, we can only describe that as institutional racism. And so there's supposed to be equal educational opportunity for all. And the mental health bodies of the United States, the American Psychological Association, the American Counseling Psychology Association, American Sociological Association, they've all issued formal statements on the harm that Native American mascots create in K-12 environments. And so we, elected leaders of the First Nations, are simply saying, yes, we see the harm that's happening, and we hope that we collectively, as the elected leadership of the state, make decisions for the safety and well-being of all youth within the state.
And Aaron, in our last minute or so, we see the State of the Tribes address every year. Do you feel like the messages are heard, or are, you know, is it kind of a people listen politely and go back to their business in state government?
I think it's an extraordinarily important moment for all of us to consider these issues collectively together. So I think people are moved by different aspects of those priorities that the First Nations leaders bring to the attention of the combined Senate and the Assembly. At the same time, people have their own agendas. They're elected to represent different parts of the public, and everybody has different hopes, I think, and dreams to some degree. And hopefully we realize the common issues that impact all of us, and that we can come to a consensus on how we can address those common priorities together. And so I think, for the most part, it's an extraordinarily amazing opportunity for listening about from the perspective of the peoples who've lived here for thousands and thousands of years, and maybe learn something about how we can be here ourselves, our descendants will be here in a few thousand years, and hopefully we've made decisions that they have a high quality of life, just as we have had a pretty high quality of life here in the Western Great Lakes.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Aaron Bird Bear, Assistant Dean for Student Diversity Programs for the UW-Madison School of Education, also a Principal Architect of Wisconsin, FirstNations.org. He joins today for a look at the State of the Tribes address delivered earlier today at the state legislature. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, college students in Appleton are working this week with a photographer who's been traveling the country to visit every Native American tribe. We'll talk to her about her project and her time here in Wisconsin. First, President Trump has designated an elite arm of Iran's military as a foreign terrorist organization. It's the first time the U.S. has branded a foreign government entity that way. The action against the Revolutionary Guard came at the request of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who faced a tough re-election bid today. The move was reportedly opposed by some national security officials in the Trump administration, warning Iran could target American troops and intelligence officers. In response, Iran designated U.S. Central Command, which oversees American military operations in the Middle East, as a terrorist organization. Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near Eastern and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Before we get into this move from the Trump administration, can you talk about what the Revolutionary Guard is? We often describe it as an elite military unit in Iran, but it's a lot more than that, right?
It is. I mean, the IRGC carries not only paramilitary operations, but they also take the lead when it comes to Iran's various clients around the region. They're the ones that interact perhaps most closely with Hezbollah in Lebanon, ostensibly on the front line in Syria, as well as being quite active in Iraq, particularly when it came to that country's dealings with ISIS.
And practically speaking, what does this designation of this organization as a terrorist group mean?
In real terms, it probably doesn't really change the dynamics too much, except, of course, it allows for Iran to once again be antagonized, provoked perhaps, perhaps I think that might be one of the objectives that the Trump administration is trying to achieve. But also, it then also gives license to call for and to implement more and more punitive sanctions against Iran, along with, of course, the many sanctions that already are underway on the regime.
Here's how Secretary of State Mike Pompeo argued for the move.
We're doing it because the Iranian regime's use of terrorism as a tool of statecraft makes it fundamentally different from any other government. This historic step will deprive the world's leading state sponsor of terror the financial means to spread misery and death around the world.
Is it fair to say that the Iranian regime, and in particular the Revolutionary Guard, uses terrorism as a tool of statecraft, as the secretary said?
Well, I think, again, whenever we're using the word terrorism, it is oftentimes seen not in the eye of the beholder, but in the eye of the accuser. And when it comes to the tactics that the Revolutionary Guard implements, one could perhaps make the same case for that of other regimes. And as you see now in the case of Iran, having designated the U.S. military to be a terrorist organization, it almost makes the term meaningless and irrelevant because it is used so freely and cavalierly, and also because there really is no set standard when it comes to international law or international convention in not only how to use the word, but what are then the consequences of such a designation being put into place.
This came on the eve of the Israeli election, and the current prime minister there, Benjamin Netanyahu, said, hey, I requested this and the Trump administration delivered. How does that factor in the Israeli election and this Iranian designation by the White House?
Well, the White House and the State Department designation of the Revolutionary Guard is the latest in a series of steps, which it appears that the Trump administration has tried to use to burnish Prime Minister Netanyahu's candidacy in today's elections, which it seems didn't really work that well because there was no clear-cut winner. Both he and his main opponent, Gantz, are claiming victory. And it seems as though from the exit polls that Likud, Prime Minister Netanyahu's party, did not even capture the most seats in the Israeli Knesset. But it seems as though if we take a broader look at some of the various declarations that have been made of late by the Trump administration, example, the U.S. recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights in southwest Syria, an area that Israel took in the 1967 Six-Day War and has held on to it despite it being regarded a violation of international law. These all seem to be ones to mollify Prime Minister Netanyahu, despite there being not only international criticism and condemnation of it, but also quite a bit of criticism from certain quarters of the U.S. government as well.
Talking to Saeed Khan, senior lecturer in Near Eastern and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit, looking at the move by the Trump administration to declare Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization. Saeed, reportedly some defense officials pushed back on this idea. They're worried about what happens in Iraq, where at some point Iranian-backed militia have fought against the U.S. or U.S.-backed interests. In some cases, they fought on the same side against ISIS. What does this designation potentially mean for what goes on in Iraq?
Well, I think it shows again that the situation in Iraq is very volatile. It's also very complex. And so to then go ahead and deem the Revolutionary Guard and designate it as a terrorist organization complicates many of the minute details by which this rather delicate balance is kept in place in an area as volatile as Iraq. It has certainly been shown that the Revolutionary Guard and the U.S. military were cooperating and coordinating when it came to pushing back on ISIS. So in the event that ISIS takes on a new incarnation or has a reemergence, that is not going to be an available tactic or an available alliance or relationship that is going to exist. Broadly, though, there is the danger of not just Iran, but many regimes taking this as a step by which to then label American interests directly as well as their indirect operations through other governments and other entities as being terrorist organizations. So it really sets a very dangerous precedent for the way that geopolitics is going to be moving forward.
And it seems like there's some confusion from Iraqi officials wondering if this designation applies to people who might have worked with the Revolutionary Guard, again, maybe in efforts coordinated against ISIS, against Shiite officials in Iraq who may have connections there. What does this do for internal Iraqi politics?
Well, I mean, I think it throws it into a greater level of chaos. And you're absolutely right that when it comes to the way that U.S. law is written, that lending material support to a terrorist organization is very, very dangerous. And I think the irony is that it could also apply to American entities that may have either inadvertently or intentionally been working with the Revolutionary Guard. It's unclear to see how that's going to play out. But as with many of these declarations that are made out of the White House, it usually doesn't come with an awful lot of nuance or a lot of specification as to what are the terms.
And there's been some concern from observers that this move is something that's going to unite the leadership in Iran, which is not always monolithic, but they pretty universally seem to be pushing against this move.
Just last week, Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, in fact, made a statement in which he says that the more that there is going to be an international effort, and when he meant international, he was actually being a bit diplomatic. He meant U.S. efforts to try to further demonize Iran, try to antagonize and perhaps even provoke the regime to make a misstep, which would then give license for some kind of a military strike, something which National Security Advisor John Bolton and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are both apparently baying for it to occur, that this is going to then simply unite the people, that irrespective of the kind of perhaps frustration that the Iranian people feel because of the economic sanctions, and yes, they certainly are having an adverse impact on the economy there, that all this is going to be seen as is an external effort to yet once again meddle in, interfere in, and try to topple the political and the socioeconomic landscape of Iran. I mean, this is a country that still remembers very, very well that in 1953, the United States helped topple a democratically elected Mohammad Mossadegh, who was prime minister.
In our last few moments, Saeed, what are you watching for next now that this announcement is on the table?
Well, I think the main thing to see is beyond the rhetoric coming out of Iran, whether or not this is leading to the greater influence of people like Secretaries Pompeo and Ambassador Bolton at the National Security Advisor, that if they feel frustrated moving on in the remaining year and a half of the Trump administration, are they moving toward escalating not just the rhetoric, but other provocative actions, which may then lead to some kind of a military confrontation directly involving Iran?
We'll leave it there for now. Saeed, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Saeed Khan, a senior lecturer in Near Eastern and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. We talked to them about President Trump's designation of Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a foreign terrorist organization. What do you think about that idea? You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or share your thoughts on Twitter. We are at Central Time WPR. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Students at Lawrence University in Appleton are getting the chance this week to work with an artist who spent the last 6 years documenting contemporary Native American life. She's made it her goal to visit every tribal community in the country and represent members on their own terms. Matika Wilbur is a photographer from the Swinomish and Tulalip tribe who's been traveling the U.S. as part of her Project 562. This Thursday at 11 a.m., she'll be giving a convocation address on the Lawrence University campus and unveiling a new mural she put together with the students there. She talked earlier today with Central Time producer Dean Knetter.
Well, we spoke to you on the network back in 2014 when Project 562 was getting underway. How far have things come in the last 5 years?
Oh, Project 562 has, I've been on the road now for a total of 6 years. I've been to about 450 tribal communities, and I still have a bit left to go. I'm heading up to Alaska this spring, and we'll be up there traveling for the next 6 months, and then I guess we turn everything into the publisher next spring, so I guess it'll be like a sacred number, 7 years total on the road.
And I think for a lot of us, the photographs we encounter of different Native American tribes come from textbooks. And these were usually from a long time ago and certainly not taken with a Native American behind the camera. When you visit people and take their pictures, what do you try to capture?
I try to give the individuals that I photograph an agency to be photographed in the way that they would like to be represented. So it's kind of a funny answer to your question, because I don't know that I'm necessarily trying to capture anything. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's kind of a colonizer's position, like I'm coming to your community wanting something from you. Instead, I try to take more of an approach of service and ask myself how I can be useful to the communities that I'm photographing. And so when I reach out to new communities, I ask them if there's any initiatives or actions that would be helpful for me to photograph, or if there's any people who, you know, that the community would really like to be sure that they have interviewed and photographed, maybe elderly folks or young people they'd like to uplift. And in that way, I just try to be useful.
What are some of those initiatives that you've included? Some of the ways that you've seen tribes sort of making the future in their own way?
I've encountered several communities that are in the midst of decolonizing and healing from, you know, many of the historical traumas and aiming to create healthy communities. And so in that way, there's sovereignty movements and government and efforts to create healthy, happy communities. There's efforts to maintain access to land and water. There's food sovereignty movements with our seed savers and our efforts to continue farming, hunting, gathering, fishing, and eating traditional food diets. You know, there's, like, of course, massive movements in education to try to both create K-12 charter schools, and our many of our people would like to see our communities continue to speak our traditional languages. And so many tribes have developed language programs that are very advanced, that, you know, these incredible charter schools or tribal schools that teach indigenous pedagogy. I mean, I could go on and on and on. It's like saying, you know, like, what are some of the forward-thinking initiatives in the United States? It's like,
it sounds like there's a lot going on. And I mean, 562 tribes is a lot to visit, and that's not a group that we can paint with a broad brush. Where do you see the differences and the commonalities coming out between different tribes? Are there certain concerns that tie them together, but certain concerns that maybe make them unique too?
I mean, of course, we're talking about nations and you know, geographical regions that are so different than one another. So some of the initiatives in the Arctic, you know, like with efforts to save the caribou, are much different than what's happening in southern Florida with an effort to restore the Everglades. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways, it's the same fight, right? Like, all tribal people are in an effort to maintain access to traditional land and water, and an effort to try to maintain tribal sovereignty, especially given the current administration. But, you know, like, that fight looks different, whether it's in Bear's Ears or in Standing Rock or in the Northwest with an effort to restore the fish habitats. You know, I would say, like, that you would find Native people at the forefront of almost every major environmental protection movement in the United States. And I definitely have seen that similarly across tribes, that there's this ongoing effort to maintain access because, you know, modern infrastructure and modern development deeply damages the ecosystem. And if our identities are inextricably connected to the land, and the land is constantly in danger, then so is our identity. And so one question is, how can I maintain my land-based identity if I don't have access to land? And, of course, the reservation system was designed to destroy that relationship. And so I would definitely say that I've seen that over and over and over again. And then, of course, I've also seen really beautiful things. I've been really well taken care of in Indian country. have encountered so many people who have invited me into their home and let me stay with them and their family and fed me and treated me well and given me stories and songs and shared their experiences with me. And in that way, I feel really grateful.
We're talking with Matika Wilbur right now. She's a photographer who's been traveling the country taking portraits of people from every Native American tribe. And you are the artist in residency this week at Lawrence University in Appleton. How has it been so far? What kind of things have you been up to?
I've had the best time. We have a group of students from both Green Bay and from here, from both of the different Native student unions. And we've started out just by sort of getting to know one another, and I gave some small lecture. We worked with around this idea of like, what does it mean to have representation, and how might we indigenize our education, in which ways do we see ourselves represented? And we had quite a few discussions about that in the first evening. And the second day we went out to Oneida and we were able to visit their longhouse, and people shared with us some traditional teachings, and it was really powerful. And then we started painting yesterday, and we'll be, you know, working on the mural for the next couple of days, reflecting some of the teachings that we learned while we were in Oneida. So it's really going well. It's really great to see the kids so inspired and enthusiastic. And I shouldn't call them kids, they're young adults, but they've done a really good job. They're working very hard, and I'm really impressed.
And you mentioned that you visited the Oneida Nation as part of your work with students. What kind of conversations did they have with tribal members?
Well, we spoke about the Great Law and the Haudenosaunee Confederacy and the power of a good mind. We discussed some longhouse teachings. We had the opportunity to give thanks in the longhouse for the maple tree. It was a full day. And many teachings were shared. It was really beautiful.
As we wrap up, Matika, you mentioned that you were working on a mural that will be unveiled this Thursday. I know it's not it's not public yet, but what can you tell us about what it's going to look like?
It's a really bright, happy mural. The students chose the color palette. I was sort of hoping for a more like muted pink tone, and they went with a really bright and cheery color palette. So you'll have to come and see. It's really beautiful. There's Daniel Clay Stevens, who's from Oneida, will be in the mural, and a Cheyenne grandmother, Jenny Parker, and a princess from Pechanga. So it has some good representation. The students did some drawings that will also be included. And it's a very collaborative effort, so I think it represents Indigenous people from many different places really well. I'm looking forward to it. It's huge. It's quite breathtaking. I hope people like it.
Well, Matika, thank you for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your time here in Wisconsin.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I hope that people, if they want to come and visit on Thursday, they're welcome to join us.
Matika Wilbur is a photographer visiting every tribal community in the country as part of Project 562. It sounds like there will be a book in the works in the future. Keep an eye out for that. She'll be giving a convocation address and unveiling that new mural that she was just talking about there. That's at 11 a.m. this Thursday at Lawrence University. She's visiting there and has been working with students at Lawrence University. She spoke earlier with Central Time producer Dean Knetter. If you're one of those students, we'd love to hear from you about the project you've been working on with Matika. Send us a quick note. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. And on a related note, we had the State of the Tribes address here in Wisconsin earlier today at the state capitol. Watch for archived audio of that. You can find that. It might be up by now at WPR.org. You've had pizza with cheese, probably, right? And maybe you've had pizza with more than one kind of cheese. I've seen four cheese pizzas at restaurants. Poking around online, I saw some recipes and menu items with five or six or beyond. They get few and far between the higher the number of cheeses goes. Now, y'all ready for this? How about a pizza with 154 different kinds of cheese in the topping? No, it's not a science fiction story from the distant future. It happened. But not here in Wisconsin, which is kind of sad. It was in faraway Melbourne, Australia. Pizza maker Johnny DiFrancesco of the restaurant 400 Gradi made the super cheese pizza, establishing a new Guinness World Record. They track these things. The previous record was only a measly 111 kinds of cheese on pizza. For the test run, the pizza maker used 1 gram each of the 154 cheeses. Now, to visualize that, a gram is a pretty small amount. Now, he didn't stop at just one pizza. He made and sold hundreds of these. Now, how did he do it? Not sprinkling those grams on one at a time. He melted down blocks of the 154 cheeses, combined them into a super cheese, reformed them, and then grated the resulting super cheese onto the pizzas. Can only imagine what it tasted like. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.